How the vengefulness of an abandoned, angry boy had burned down the world, but it hadn't made Sebastian happy. Revenge had only made Sebastian and Thule miserable, though he had conquered all he saw. There was a knock on the door. Emma shoved the shoebox into her closet and went to answer it. To her surprise, it was Julian. She would have thought he would have been downstairs with the others. They'd had a big dinner in the library, delivery Thai food, and everyone was there, reminiscing and joking. Magnus dozing gently in Alex's arms while they were both sprawled on the couch. It was almost as if Jason Clary didn't have to leave on a dangerous mission at dawn. But that was the Shadowhunter way. There were always missions. There was always a dangerous dawn. Emma had wanted to be with them, but to be around Julian and other people when he was like this hurt. It hurt to look at him, and to conceal what she knew, and to wonder if others noticed, and if so, what they thought. Julian went to lean against the windowsill. The stars were just coming out, pinpointing the sky with scraps of light. "I think I messed up things with Ty," he said. "He wanted to talk to me, and I don't think I responded the right way." Emma brushed off her knees. She was wearing a pale green vintage nightgown that doubled as a dress. "What did he want to talk to you about?" A few loose curls of dark chocolate hair tumbled over Julian's forehead. He was still beautiful, Emma thought. It didn't make any difference what she knew. She ached at the sight of his painter's hands, strong and articulate, the soft darkness of his hair, the cupid's bow of his lip, the color of his eyes, the way he moved, his artist's grace, the things about him that whispered Julian to her. "I don't know," he said. "I didn't understand it. I would have understood it. I know I would have, if it weren't for the spell."
"You went up on that pyre for him," she said.
"I know. I told you it was like a survival instinct, something I had no control over. But this isn't a matter of living or dying. It's emotions, and so my mind won't process them."
"Emotions can be matters of living and dying." Emma pointed to her closet. "Do you know why I took all that down?"
Julian's brow furrowed. "You're done with it," he said. "You found out who killed your parents. You don't need that stuff anymore." She sighed.
"Yes and no, I guess.
If everything goes well, hopefully Magnus can take the spell off me tomorrow, or the day after," said Julian. "It depends on how fast the cure works."
"You could have talked to him about it already," Emma said, moving to lean against the sill beside Julian. It reminded her of past, better times, when they'd both sit on the wide sill and read, or Julian would draw, silent and content for hours at a time. "Why wait?"
"I can't tell him all of it," Julian said. "I can't show him what I wrote on my arm. He'd want to take the spell off right away, and he's not strong enough. It could kill him."
Emma turned to him in surprise. "That's empathy, Julian. That's you understanding what Magnus might feel. That's good, right?"
"Maybe," he said. "There's something I've been doing when I'm not sure how to handle something emotional. I try to imagine what you would do, what you would take into account. The conversation with Ty went too fast for me to do it, but it does help."
"What would I do?"
"It all breaks down when I'm with you, of course," he said. "I can't think of what you would want me to do about you or around you. I can't see you through your own eyes. Can't even see me through your eyes."
He touched her bare arm lightly, where her parabatai rune was, tracing its edges. She could see his reflection in the window, another Julian with the same sharp profile, the same shadowed lashes.
"You have a talent, Emma," he said. "A goodness that makes people happy. You assume people are not just capable of their best, but that they want to be their best. You assume the same about me."
Emma tried to breathe normally. The feeling of his fingers on her rune was making her body tremble.
"You believe in me.
more than I believe in myself. His fingers traced the path down her bare arm, to her wrist, and back up. They were light and clever fingers. He touched her as if he were sketching her body, tracing the lines of her collarbones, grazing the notch at the base of her throat, gliding down to run along the neckline of her dress, just grazing the upper curve of her breasts. Emma shivered. She could lose herself in this sensation she knew, could drown in it and forget, shield herself behind it. "If you're going to do that," she said, "you should kiss me." He folded her into his arms. His mouth on hers was warm and soft, a gentle kiss deepening into heat. Her hands moved over his body, the feel of it now familiar to her, the smooth muscles under his t-shirt, the roughness of scars, the delicacy of shoulder blades, the curving hollow of his spine. He murmured that she was beautiful, that he wanted her, that he always had. Her heart was beating its way out of her chest. Every one of her cells was telling her that this was Julian, her Julian, that he felt, tasted, breathed the same, and that she loved him. "This is perfect," he whispered against her mouth. "This is how we can be together and not hurt anyone." Her body screamed at her not to react, just go along with it. But her mind betrayed her.
"What do you mean, exactly?"
He looked at her with his dark hair half in his face. She wanted to pull him to her and cover his mouth with more kisses. She wanted to close her eyes and forget anything was wrong. But she had never had to close her eyes with Julian before. "It's the emotions that matter, not the act," he said. "If I'm not in love with you, we can do this. Be together, physically. It won't matter to the curse."
"If I'm not in love with you..."
She stepped away from him. It felt as if she were tearing her own skin open, as if she would look down and see blood seeping from the wounds where she had ripped herself away from him.
"I can't," she said. "When you get your feelings back, we'll both regret that we did this, when you didn't care."
He looked puzzled. "I want you just as much as I ever did. That hasn't changed."
She felt suddenly weary. "I believe you. You just told me you wanted me, that I was beautiful, but you didn't say you loved me. You've always said that before."
There was a brief flicker in his eyes. "I'm not the same person. I can't say I feel things I don't understand."
"Well, I'm the same person," she said. "I want Julian Blackthorne, my Julian Blackthorne."
He reached to touch her face. She stepped back, away from him, not because she disliked his touch, but because she liked it too much. Her body didn't know the difference between this Julian and the one she needed. "So, who am I to you, then?" he asked, dropping his hand.
"You are the person I have to protect until my Julian comes back to live inside you again," she said. "I don't want this. I want the Julian I love. You might be in the cage, Jules, but as long as you are like this, I am in the cage with you."
Morning came as it always did, with sunshine and the annoying chirp of birds. Emma staggered out of her bedroom with her head pounding and discovered Christina lurking in the hallway outside her door. She was holding a mug of coffee and wearing a pretty peach sweater with pearls around the collar. Emma had slept only about 3 hours after Julian had left her room, and they'd been a bad 3 hours at that. When she slammed the bedroom door behind her, Christina jumped nervously into the air.
"How much coffee have you had?"
Emma asked. She pulled her hair up and secured it with a yellow daisy-printed cloth band.
"This is my third. I feel like a hummingbird."
Christina waved the mug and fell into step beside Emma as they headed to the kitchen.
"I need to talk to you, Emma."
"Why?" Emma said wearily.
"My love life is a disaster," said Christina.
"Que lio."
"Oh, good," said Emma. "I was afraid it was going to be something about politics."
Christina looked tragic.
kissed Kieran.
What? Where?
Emma demanded, almost falling down the steps.
In fairy, Christina wailed.
Actually, I meant, like, on the cheek or what?
No, Christina said. A real kiss, with mouths. How was it?
Emma was fascinated. She couldn't picture kissing Kieran. He always seemed so cold and so removed. He was certainly beautiful, but the way a statue was beautiful, not a person. Christina blushed all over her face and neck.
It was lovely, she said in a small voice. Gentle, and as if he cared very much for me.
That was even stranger. However, Emma felt the point was to strive to be supportive of Christina. She would rather Christina was with Mark, of course, but Mark had been mucking about rather, and there was that binding spell. Well, Emma said, what happens in fairy stays in fairy, I guess.
If you mean I shouldn't tell Mark, he knows, said Christina. And if you're going to ask me if I want to be with Mark alone, I cannot answer that either. I do not know what I want.
What about how Mark and Kieran feel about each other, said Emma. Is it still romantic?
I think they love each other in a way I cannot touch, said Christina. And there was a sadness in her voice that made Emma want to stop dead in the middle of the hallway and put her arms around her friend.
But they'd already reached the kitchen. It was crowded with people. Emma could smell coffee, but not food cooking. The table was bare, the kitchen range cold. Julian and Helen, along with Mark and Kieran, were crowded around the table, where Clary and Jace sat, all of them looking with disbelief down at a piece of official-looking paper. Emma stopped dead, Christina wide-eyed beside her.
We thought, did you already go to Idris and come back? I thought you had to leave at dawn, Emma said.
Jace glanced up.
We never left, he said. Clary was still staring at the paper she held, her face white and stunned.
Was there a problem? Emma asked anxiously.
You might say that. Jace's tone was light, but his golden eyes were stormy. He tapped the paper. It's a message from the Clave. According to this, Clary and I are dead.
Zara always chose the same chair in the Inquisitor's office. Manuel suspected it was because she liked to sit beneath the portrait of herself, so that people would be forced to gaze at two Zaras and not just one.
Reports have been coming in all day, said Zara, twirling one of her braids. Institutes are responding with outrage to the news of Jace and Clary's death at fairy hands.
As we expected, said Horace, shifting in his chair with a grunt of pain. It annoyed Manuel that Horace was still complaining about his arm, a mass of white bandages below the stump of his elbow. Surely the Arazis would have healed the cut, and Horace had only himself to blame for letting the Rayburn bitch get the better of him. Manuel detested Horace. But then Manuel detested true believers in general. He couldn't have given less of a damn whether there were downworlders in Alicante or fairies in Brosselin Forest or werewolves in his bathtub. Prejudice against downworlders struck him as boring and unnecessary. The only thing it was useful for was making people afraid. When people were afraid, they would do anything he wanted if they thought it would make them safe again. When Horace spoke of reclaiming the past glory of Nephilim and the crowds cheered, Manuel knew what they were truly cheering for, and it was not glory. It was the cessation of fear. The fear they had since the Dark War had made them understand that they were not invincible. Once they believed they had been invincible. They had stood with their boots on the necks of downworlders and demons, and they had straddled the world. Now they recalled the burning bodies in Angel Square, and they were afraid. And fear was useful. Fear could be manipulated into more power. And power was all Manuel cared about in the end.
Have we heard anything from the Los Angeles Institute? Horace asked, lounging behind his large desk.
We know from Fairy that the Blackthorns and their companions returned home.
But what do they know?
What do they know?
Horace and Zara had wondered the same when Dane's body had come back to them, nearly dismembered. Dane had been a fool, creeping away from Oban's camp in the middle of the night to seek the glory of retrieving the black volume on his own. And he'd taken their time slippage medallion with him, which had meant that Manuel had discovered he'd lost a day or two when he'd returned to Idris. Manuel suspected there was a longsword wound under those kelpie bites, but he didn't mention it to the Dearborns. They saw what they wanted to see, and if Emma and Julian knew that Horace had sent an assassin on their trail, it wouldn't matter for much longer.
"About Clary and Jace?" Manuel said. "I'm sure they know that they disappeared through the portal into Thule. It will be impossible to get them back, though. Time has passed. The portal is closed, and Oban assured me Thule is a deadly place. By now they will be bones, bleaching in the sand of another world."
"The Blackthorns and that Emma wouldn't dare say anything against us anyway," said Zara. "We still hold their secret in the palms of our hands." She touched Cortana's hilt. "Besides, nothing of theirs will be theirs for much longer, not even the Institute. A few others may stand against us, Mexico City, Buenos Aires, Mumbai, but we will deal with them all."
Zara was also a true believer, Manuel thought with some distaste. She was a stick and a bore, and he had never believed Diego Rocio Rosales actually saw anything in her. On balance, he seemed to have turned out to be right. He suspected Diego was languishing in jail as much for rejecting Zara as he was for helping some idiot fairy run away from the Scholomance. Horace turned to Manuel.
"What about your phase of the plan, Villalobos?"
"Everything is in order. The Unseelie forces are massing under King Oban. When they arrive at the walls of Alicante, we will ride out to show our willingness to parley with them on the imperishable fields. We will make sure all shadow hunters in Alicante see us. After this charade, we will return to the council and tell them that the Fae have surrendered. The cold peace will be over, and in return for their willingness to help us, all entrances to Faerie will be sealed off with wards. It will be made off-limits to shadow hunters."
"Very good," said Horace. "But with the portal of Thule closing, where does that leave us with the Blight?"
"Exactly where we want to be," Manuel said. He was pleased. Pretending they wished to destroy the Blight with fire had been his idea. He'd known it wouldn't work, and the failure would leave the Nephilim more frightened than before.
"The poison has spread far enough for our purposes. The Claif all know of the Blight now, and fear what it will do."
"And fear makes them agreeable," said Horace. "Zara?"
"The warlocks are growing sicker," Zara said with relish. "No reported transformations yet, but many institutes have taken in warlocks in an effort to heal them.
Once they turn into demons, you can imagine the bloody chaos that will ensue."
"Which should make it easy to enact martial law and rid ourselves of the rest of the warlocks," said Horace.
The fact that the Blight would serve not just to frighten shadow hunters, but also to harm warlocks had always been seen as a plus by Horace, though Manuel saw a little point in an exercise that would seriously limit the shadow hunters' ability to do things like open portals and heal unusual illnesses. That was a problem with true believers. They were never practical.
"Ah, well. Some warlocks would probably survive," he reasoned. "Once all the cohort's demands were met, they could afford to be generous and destroy the Blight for good." It wasn't as if Horace was fond of the Blight or its propensity to deaden angelic magic. It was simply a useful tool, as the Larkspears had been.
"Are you not worried that the transformed warlocks will get out of control and slaughter shadow hunters, even mundanes?"
"I am not," said Horace. "A properly trained shadow hunter should be able to handle a warlock turned demon. If they cannot, then we have done our society a favor in culling them."
"My question is whether Oban can be trusted," said Zara, curling her lip. "He's a fairy, after all."
"He can," said Manuel. "He is far more malleable than his father was. He wants his kingdom, and we want ours. If we bring him Prince Kieran's head as promised, he will be very pleased indeed.
Horace sighed.
If only these arrangements did not have to be secret. The whole of the clave should glory in the rightness of our plan.
But they don't like fairies, Papa, said Zara, who was, as always, incredibly literal. They wouldn't like making deals with them, or encouraging them to bring the blight into Idris, even if it was for a worthy cause. It is illegal to work with demonic magic, though I know it's necessary, she added hastily. I wish Samantha and Dane were still around. Then we could talk to them.
Manuel thought with little interest of Dane, undone by his own stupidity, and of Samantha, currently raving her head off in the Basilius. He doubted either of them would have been much help, even in their former states.
It is a lonely burden, daughter, to be the ones tasked with doing the right thing, said Horace pompously.
Zara got up from her chair and patted his shoulder.
Poor Papa. Do you want to look into the scrying mirror one more time? It always cheers you up.
Manuel sat up in his chair. A scrying mirror was one of the few things he didn't find boring. Oban had magicked it to reflect the fields before the Unseelie Tower. Zara held up the mirror so that the light from the demon towers sparked off its silver handle. She gave a little squeal as the glass turned clear, and through it they saw the green fields of Unseelie and the Anthracite Tower. Lined up in front of the tower were row upon row of Unseelie warriors, so many that the view of them filled the scene, even as the rows diminished into the distance, an army without limit, without end. Their swords shone in the sunlight like a vast field planted with razor-sharp blades.
What do you think? Said Horace with pride, as if he himself had put together the army. Spectacular, isn't it, Annabel?
The woman with the long, dark brown hair, sitting silently in the corner of the room, nodded calmly. She wore clothes that matched the ones she had worn that bloody day in the council hall. Zara had dredged up near-exact copies, but it was Manuel who had first thought of deploying them, as if they were themselves a weapon.
There were few things stronger than fear.
Since the council meeting, the Shadow Hunters had been terrified of Annabel Blackthorn. If she appeared before them, they would cower behind Horace. His ability to protect them would be all they cared about. And when it came to Julian Blackthorn and the rest of his irritating family, there would be more than just fear. There would be rage, hatred, all emotions the cohort could exploit.
Horace gave a nervous laugh and turned back to studying the mirror.
Hidden by the lengthening shadows, Manuel grinned savagely. Absolutely nobody was prepared for what was coming. Just the way he liked it.
Chapter 24 The Long Nighttime.
Aline Penhallow, head of the Los Angeles Institute. White banners of mourning fly over our capital city today, and green flags to speed the healing of our hearts. Heroes of the Dark War, Jonathan Herondale and Clarissa Fairchild, have been slain by unseelie hands. They were on a mission for the Clave, and their deaths will be celebrated as the deaths of heroes. Their bodies have yet to be recovered. Such a brutal breakage of the Cold Peace must be reckoned with. Starting this morning, at sunrise in Alicante, we shall consider ourselves in a state of war with fairy kind. Members of the Council will reach out to the court to seek parley and reparations. If a fairy is seen outside their lands, you are free to capture them and bring them to Alicante for questioning. If you must slay the fairy in question, you will not be in breach of the accords. Fairies are cunning, but we will prevail and avenge our fallen heroes. As always, in a state of war, individual shadow hunters are expected to return to Idris to report for duty within 48 hours. Please notify the Clave of your travel plans, as portal activity into Idris will be monitored.
Horace Dearborn, Inquisitor. N.B. As our consul, Gia Penhallow, is suspected of involvement with fairies, she is being held in the guard tower until such time as she can be questioned.
Gia? Emma said in disbelief. They jailed the consul?
Aline's trying to reach Patrick, said Helen in a low voice. House arrest is one thing, but this is another. Aline's frantic.
Who knows you're alive? Alec demanded, turning to Jace. Who knows that what's in this letter isn't true?
Jace looked startled. The people in this house. Magnus.
Where is Magnus?
Sleeping, Alec said. So, besides us? Simon and Izzy, Mom, Maya, and Bat, that's all. He swiveled around in his chair. Why, do you think we should go to Alicante? Expose their lies?
No, Julian said. His voice was quiet but firm. You can't do that.
Why not? Helen said.
Because this isn't a mistake, said Julian. This is a false flag operation. They believe you're dead. They wouldn't risk this if they didn't. And they're pinning the blame on Ferry to encourage a war.
Why would anyone want a war? Said Helen. Didn't they see what the last one did?
People seize power in wars, said Julian. If they make fairies the enemy, they can make themselves the heroes. Everyone will forget the complaints they had about the current council. They'll unite behind them in a common cause. A war can begin with a single death. Here they have two, and both are famous, heroes to the Clave. Both Jace and Clary looked uncomfortable.
I see a flaw in this plan, said Jace. They still have to fight and win a war.
Maybe, said Julian. Maybe not. Depends on what the plan is. I see another flaw, said Clary.
We're not actually dead.
It's pretty cocky of them to think they can get away with pretending we are.
I think they believe it, said Emma. The fight in the court was chaos.
They probably don't realize who went through the portal into Thule and who didn't. And who knows what Manuel told them. He likes to bend the truth anyway, and without the mortal sword, he can bend it away. I bet he wants a war.
But surely the council won't truly support the idea of a war with Ferry, said Clary. Or do you think the whole council is lost to us?
Emma was surprised. Clary was looking at Julian as if she were deeply invested in his answer, though she was 5 years older. It was strange to think Julian's sharp brilliance didn't just belong to her, to his family.
Enough of them are, said Julian. Enough of them have already gotten behind the cohort and its message. Otherwise, they wouldn't be demanding that we all return to Alicante in 2 days.
But we're not going to do that, said Mark. We cannot go back to Alicante now. It is under the cohort's control.
The last time we were there, Horace sent us on a suicide mission, Emma pointed out. I don't think we'd all be safe in Idris.
It was a sobering thought. Idris was their homeland, meant to be the safest place in the world for shadow hunters.
We're not going, Helen said. Not only would it be unsafe, but it would mean abandoning the warlocks to the ravages of the Blight.
But Jace and Clary can't go to Lake Lynn, said Alec. His black hair was standing up in a ruffled mess, and his hands were tightened into fists. All portal activity is being monitored.
That's why you didn't leave at dawn, Emma said,
wondering how long Clary and Jace had been sitting here, staring at the letter in horror.
There has to be some way, Jace said, gazing at Alec with desperation. Clary and I can travel overland, or...
You can't, Emma interrupted. There are pieces of this I don't understand, but I can tell you one thing. The cohort is using your deaths to get what they want. If the two of you go to Alicante and the cohort hears about it, even a whisper, they'll put everything they've got into killing you.
Emma's right, said Julian. They have to keep believing you're dead.
Then I'll go, Alec said. Clary can make me a portal to somewhere near Idris, and I can cross the border on foot.
Alec, no. Magnus needs you here, Clary said. Besides, you're the head of the Downworlder Shadowhunter Alliance. The cohort would love to get their hands on you.
Kieran rose to his feet. None of you can go, he said. What you Nephilim lack is subtlety. You would go galloping into Idris, bringing disaster down on all of us.
Meanwhile, fairies can slip into Idris as swift as a shadow and bring back what you need.
Fairies? Jace raised an eyebrow. You seem to be one fairy. Maybe two if you count half of Helen and half of Mark.
Kieran looked annoyed.
Fairies are forbidden to even set foot in the soil of Idris, said Alec. There are probably wards up and censers.
Isn't it convenient that there are fairy steeds who fly, Kieran said, and riders who ride those steeds, and that I am one?
This is kind of a rude way of offering help, said Jace, and caught Clary's eye. But I'm all in, he added. Are you offering to fly into Idris and collect the water?
Kieran had begun to pace. His dark hair had turned deep blue, threaded with white strands.
You will need more than one fairy. You will need a legion. Those who can fly into Idris, collect the water, destroy the blight, and bring the cure to warlocks all over the world. You need the Wild Hunt.
The Hunt? Said Mark. Even with Gwen as a friend of Diana's, I do not think the Hunt would do this for Nephilim.
Kieran drew himself up. For the first time, Emma saw some of his father in his stance and in the set of his jaw.
I am a prince of fairy and a hunter, he said. I kill the Unseelie King with my own hands. I believe they will do it for me.
On the roof, Kit could hear voices floating up from the kitchen below, raised and frantic voices. He couldn't hear what they were talking about, though.
A letter from Livy, he said, turning around to look at Ty.
The other boy was sitting at the roof's edge, his legs dangling over the side. Kit hated how close Ty was willing to get to the edges of things. Sometimes it seemed like he had no sense of spatial danger, the reality of what would happen if he fell.
The other Livy, in the other universe.
Ty nodded. His too long hair fell into his eyes, and he pushed it back impatiently. He was wearing a white sweater with holes in the cuffs that he'd pushed his thumbs through, as if he were hooking the sleeves on.
Emma gave it to me. I wondered if he wanted to read it.
Yes, Kit said. I do. Ty held it out to him, and Kit took the light envelope, looking at the scrawl on the cover. Tiberius.
Did it look like Livy's handwriting? He wasn't sure.
He didn't remember studying her handwriting. He knew he was forgetting the sound of her voice. The sun was beating down on the roof, making Ty's gold locket spark. Kit opened the letter and began to read.
Ty, I've thought so many times about what I would say to you if you reappeared suddenly. If I was walking along the street and you popped out of thin air, walking along beside me like you always used to, with your hands in your pockets and your head tilted back.
Mom used to say you walked celestially, looking up at the sky as if you were scanning the clouds for angels.
Do you remember that? In your world, I am ashes. I am ancestors. My memories and hopes and dreams have gone to build the city of bones. In your world, I am lucky, because I do not have to live in a world without you. But in this world, I am you. I am the twinless twin, so I can tell you this. When your twin leaves the earth you live on, it never turns the same way again. The weight of their soul is gone, and everything is off balance. The world rocks under your feet like an unquiet sea. I can't tell you it gets easier, but it does get steadier. You learn how to live with the new rocking of the new earth. The way sailors gain sea legs, you learn. I promise. I know you're not exactly the Ty I had in this world, my brilliant, beautiful brother. But I know from Julian that you are beautiful and brilliant, too. I know that you are loved. I hope that you are happy. Please be happy. You deserve it so much. I want to ask if you remember the way we used to whisper words to each other in the dark. Star. Twin. Glass.
but I'll never know your answer. So I'll whisper to myself as I fold this letter up and slide it into the envelope, hoping against hope it will somehow reach you. I whisper your name, Ty. I whisper the most important thing. I love you. I love you. I love you. Livy. When Kit lowered the letter, the whole world looked a little too sharp and bright, as if he were seeing it through a magnifying glass. His throat hurt. What do you think? I love you. I love you. I love you. Let him hear it. Let him believe it and let go. I think, Ty reached up for the letter and folded it back into his jacket pocket. I think this isn't my Libby. I'm sure she's a good person, but she isn't mine. Kit sat down a little suddenly. What do you mean? Ty gazed out at the ocean, at its steady incursion and recession. My Libby would want to come back to me. This one didn't. It would be interesting to meet this Libby, but it's probably good she didn't come back with him and Jules, because then we couldn't bring back the right Libby. No, Kit said. No, you don't get it. It's not that she didn't want to come back. She's needed there. I'm sure she would have wanted to be with her family if she could. Imagine having to bear that loss. I don't want to. Ty cut him off sharply. I know she feels bad. I'm really sorry for her. I am. He had taken a piece of thread from his pocket and was worrying at it with nervous hands. But that's not why I brought you the letter. You know what it is? I guess I don't, Kit said. It's the last thing we need for the spell, Ty said. It's an object from another dimension. Kit felt as if he were on a roller coaster that had suddenly, precipitously dropped. He was about to say something when Ty made a soft sound of wonder. He tilted his head back as above them flew a black and gray horse and a brown one, their hooves trailing gold and silver vapor. They both watched in silence as the horses landed on the grass in front of the Institute. One of the riders was a familiar woman in a black dress, Diana. The other was Gwyn Ap Nud, leader of the Wild Hunt. They both watched in astonishment as Gwyn dismounted before going to help Diana down. Drew clambered up onto the roof. Ty and Kit were already there, standing disturbingly close to the roof's edge. She wasn't surprised. She figured out a long time ago that whenever they wanted to talk in private, they disappeared up here, the way Emma and Julian used to when they were younger. She hadn't really talked to either of them since the time they'd gone into Ty's room. She didn't know what to say. Everyone else in the family, Helen, Mark, was talking about how Ty was recovering, how strong he was being, how he was holding up in the face of Livy's death. But she had seen his room torn apart and the blood on his pillowcases. It had made her look more closely at him, at how thin he was, and the scrapes across his knuckles. After their father had died, Ty had gone through a phase of biting at his own hands. He would wake up in the night, having gnawed the skin over his knuckles. She guessed he was doing that again, and that was why there was blood on his pillows. Helen and Mark couldn't recognize it. They hadn't been there years ago. Livy would have known. Julian would have known, but he had only just gotten home. And besides, talking to anyone about it seemed like a betrayal of Ty. The story of Thule haunted her too. A world in which Ty was dead, in which she herself was missing, in which the Blackthorns were no longer a family. A world where Sebastian Morgenstern had ruled. Even the name Ash haunted her, as if she'd heard it before, though she had no memory of having done so. The idea of Thule was a dark nightmare, reminding her of the fragility of the bonds that held her to her family. The last thing she wanted to do was upset Ty. And so she'd avoided him, and Kit by consequence, since they were always together. They didn't own the roof, though. She stomped over to where they were standing, making plenty of noise so she wouldn't surprise them.
They didn't seem bothered to see her.
Gwyn and Diane are here, said Kit. When he'd come to them, he had looked a bit pale, as if he'd spent most of his time indoors and at night markets. Now he had color, the beginnings of a tan and flushed cheeks. He looked more like Jace, especially as his hair had grown out and started to curl.
I know, she joined them at the roof's edge. They're going to Idris. They're going to get the water from Lake Lynn.
She filled them in quickly, pleased to be the one who had news for a change. Kieran had come out of the Institute and was walking across the grass toward Diana and Gwyn. His back was very straight, the sun bright on his blue-black hair. Kieran inclined his head to Diana and turned to Gwyn. Kieran had changed, Drew thought. She remembered the first time she'd seen him, bloody and furious and bitterly angry at the world. She had regarded him as an enemy of Mark, of all of them. She had seen different sides of him since then. He had fought alongside them. He had watched bad movies with her. She thought of him complaining about his love life the night before and laughing, and looked down at him now. Gwyn had laid a hand on his shoulder and was nodding, clear respect in his gestures.
People are made up of all sorts of different bits, Drew thought. Funny bits and romantic bits and selfish bits and brave bits. Sometimes you only saw a few of them. Maybe it was when you saw all of them that you realized you knew someone really well. She wondered if there would ever be anyone besides her family she knew like that.
We should go downstairs, Ty said, his gray eyes curious. Find out what's going on. He headed for the trap door that led to the stairs. Kit had just started to follow him when Drusilla tapped him on the shoulder. Kit turned to look at her. What is it?
Ty, she said in a low voice.
Drew glanced over at her brother automatically as she said his name. He'd already disappeared down the steps.
I want to talk to you about him, but not with anyone else around. And you have to promise not to tell him. Can you promise?
Have a good watch, Chase said, ruffling Clary's hair. Diana and Gwyn had departed for Idris. Emma had watched them vanish until they were a speck on the horizon, disappearing into the haze of the Los Angeles air. Alec had gone to be with Magnus, and the rest of them had agreed to take turns at patrolling the perimeter of the Institute.
We need to be alert, Julian had said. This message from the cohort is a loyalty test. They're going to be watching institutes to see who races to Alicante to pledge themselves to the fight against Ferry. They know we'll delay as long as possible. He gestured at Mark and Helen. But I wouldn't put it past them to move on us first.
That wouldn't be very clever, Mark said, frowning. All they have to do is wait, and they can declare us traitors soon enough.
They're not that smart, Julian had agreed grimly. Vicious, but not smart.
Unfortunately, Manuel is pretty smart, said Emma, and though everyone had looked grimmer than ever, no one had disagreed. Clary and Emma had the second watch after Jace and Helen. Helen had already gone inside to check on Aline, and Emma was trying to look off into the distance while Clary and Jace kissed and made cutesy noises at each other.
I hope everything's all right in Alicante, she said eventually, more to determine if they were still kissing than anything else.
It can't be, said Jace, breaking away from Clary. They all think I'm dead. There better be a mourning parade. We should find out who's sending flowers.
Clary rolled her eyes, not without affection.
Maybe Simon or Izzy can make a list. Then when we come back from the dead, we can send them flowers.
Women will be mourning to hear of my passing, Jace said, bounding up the steps. Garments will be rent. Rent, I tell you.
You're taken, Clary called up after him. It's not like you're a single dead hero.
Love knows no bounds, said Jace, and sobered. I'm going to check on Alec and Magnus. I'll see you two later.
He waved and vanished. Clary and Emma, both in gear, started to cut across the grass toward the path that led around the Institute. Clary sighed. Jace hates to be away from Alec at times like this. There isn't anything he can do, but I understand wanting to be with your parabatai when they're suffering. I'd want to be with Simon.
It's not like he's there just for himself, Emma said.
The sky was dark blue and chased with fading clouds. I'm sure it's better for Alec having him there. I mean, I think part of what was so awful for the Alec and Thule was that he must have felt so alone when he lost Magnus. So many of his friends were already dead, and his parabatai was worse than dead. Clary shuddered. We should talk about something more cheerful. Emma tried to think about cheerful things. Julian getting the spell taken off him, not a topic she could discuss. Zara being squished by a boulder made her seem vengeful. We could discuss your visions, she said carefully. Clary looked at her in surprise. The ones you told me about, where you saw yourself die. In the Unseelie Court, when you looked through the portal. I realized what I'd been seeing, yes, Clary said. I was seeing me, and I was dead. And I was also seeing the dream I'd been having. She took a deep breath. I haven't had it since we came back from Faerie. I think the dreams were actually trying to tell me about Thule. They had reached the place where grass turned into desert and scrub. The ocean was a thick line of blue paint in the distance. Did you tell Jace? Emma asked. No. I can't do it now. I feel so stupid. Like he might never forgive me. And besides, Jace needs to focus on Alec and Magnus. We all do. Clary kicked a small stone out of her path. I've known Magnus since I was a little girl. The first time I met him, I pulled his cat's tail. I didn't know he could have turned me into a frog or a mailbox if he wanted. Magnus will be okay, Emma said, but she knew she didn't sound sure. She couldn't be. Clary's voice shook. I just feel like if the warlocks are lost, if the cohort succeeds in pitting shadow hunters against downworlders in war, then everything I ever did was useless. Everything I gave up during the Dark War. And it means I'm not a hero. I never was. Clary stopped walking to lean against a massive boulder, one that Ty liked to climb. She was clearly struggling not to cry. Emma stared at her in horror. Clary, she said, you're the one who taught me what being a hero means. You said heroes don't always win, that they sometimes lose, but that they keep fighting. I thought I had kept fighting. Guess I thought I had won, Clary said. I've been to Thule, Emma said fiercely. That world was the way it was because you weren't in it. You were the crisis point. You made all the difference. Without you, Sebastian would have won the Dark War. Without you, so many people would be dead, and so much goodness would be gone from the world forever. Clary took a deep breath. We're never done fighting, are we? I don't think so, Emma said. Clary pushed away from the rock. They rejoined the path, curving through the desert among the shrubs, deep green and chalky violet. The sun was low over the horizon, lighting the desert sand to gold. In Thule, Emma said as they rounded the corner of the Institute, Jace was under Sebastian's mind control. But there was something I didn't say in the library. Sebastian was able to control Jace only because he lied about his involvement in your death. He was afraid that even under a spell, no matter how strong the spell was, Jace would never forgive him for letting you be hurt. And you're telling me this because, Clary eyed Emma sideways. Because Jace would forgive you for anything, said Emma. Go tell him you were being a butt for a good reason, and ask him to marry you. Clary burst out laughing. That's romantic, Emma grinned. That's just my suggestion about the sentiment. The actual proposal is up to you. Helen had given Magnus and Alec one of the largest rooms. Jay suspected it had probably belonged to the Blackthorn's parents at one time. It was odd, actually, even to think of Blackthorn parents and not to think of Julian. Quiet, competent, secretive Julian, as the one who took care of the children. But people became what they had to be. Julian probably hadn't wanted to become a parent at age 12 any more than Jace had wanted to leave Idris and lose his father at age 9.
He would not have believed it if someone had told him he would gain a new and better family in New York, just as Julian would not have believed that he would love his siblings so fiercely it would all be worth it. Or so Jace suspected, at least.
Jace looked over at Alec, the brother he had gained. Alec sat propped on one side of the big wooden bed in the room's center. Magnus lay beside him, curled on his side, his black hair stark against the white pillow. Jace hadn't seen Alec this drained and exhausted-looking since Magnus had vanished into Edom 5 years ago. Alec had gone to get him back. He would have gone anywhere for Magnus. But Jace was afraid, worse than afraid, that Magnus was going somewhere that Alec couldn't follow. He didn't want to think about what would happen if Magnus went. The story of Thule had sent icy needles through his veins. He suspected he knew what would happen to him if he lost Clary. He couldn't bear to think of Alec in such insupportable pain. Alec bent over and kissed Magnus's temple. Magnus stirred and murmured but didn't wake. Jace hadn't seen him awake since the night before. Alec looked over at Jace, his eyes deeply shadowed.
"What time is it?"
"Sunset," said Jace, who never carried a watch. "I can go find out if you need to know."
"No. It's probably too late to call the kids."
Alec rubbed the back of his hand across his eyes.
"Besides, I keep hoping I can call them with good news."
Jace stood up and went to the window. He felt like he couldn't breathe.
"Take this pain away from Alec," he prayed to the angel Raziel. "Come on, we've met. Do this for me."
It was something of an unorthodox prayer, but it was heartfelt. Alec raised an eyebrow at him. "You're praying? How did you know?" Out of the window, Jace could see the grass in front of the Institute, the highway and the ocean beyond. The whole world was going on in its ordinary way, not caring about the problems of shadow hunters and warlocks.
"Your lips were moving," said Alec. "You hardly ever pray, but I appreciate the thought."
"I don't usually have to pray," said Jace. "Usually when things go wrong, we come to Magnus and he fixes them."
"I know."
Alec picked at a stray thread on his cuff.
"Maybe we should have gotten married," he said, "Magnus and me. We've been unofficially engaged all this time, but we wanted to wait for the cold peace to be over.
For downworlders and shadow hunters to be able to be properly married." "In shadow hunter gold and warlock blue," said Jace. He'd heard this before, the explanation for why Alec and Magnus hadn't married yet, but planned to someday. He'd even gone with Alec to pick out rings for the day Alec and Magnus would finally tie the knot. Simple gold bands with the words Aku Chintakamu etched on them. He'd known the rings were a secret from Magnus because Alec wanted to surprise his partner, but he hadn't known there were fears and worries behind something they seemed so sure would happen all in due time. It was always hard to tell the truth of other people's relationships.
"Then Magnus would at least know how much I love him," Alec said, leaning forward to brush a stray hair from Magnus's forehead.
"He knows," Jay said. "You should never doubt he knows." Alec nodded. Jace glanced back out the window. "They just switched over the watch," he said. "Clary said she'd come see how Magnus was doing when she was done with his shift."
"Should I take a turn at the watch?"
Alec asked. "I don't want to let anyone down." The lump in Jace's throat ached. He sat down next to his parapetai, who he had sworn to follow, to live beside, to die with. Surely that also encompassed the sharing of burdens and grief. "This is your watch, brother," he said. Alec exhaled softly. He put one hand on Magnus's shoulder, the lightest of touches. He reached out with his other hand, and Jace took it, lacing their fingers together. They held fast to each other in silence as the sun went down over the ocean.
"So what happens?" Aline said. They stood at the edge of the bluffs, overlooking the highway and the sea. "If Magnus starts turning into a demon, what happens?"
Her eyes were red and swollen, but her back was straight.
She had talked to her father, who had told her only what he knew, that guards had come in the early morning to take Gia to the guard, that Horace Dearborn had promised no harm would come to her, but that a show of good faith was necessary to reassure those who had lost confidence. If he thought it was all lies, he didn't say so. But Aline knew it was, and had called Dearborn every name in the book to Helen the minute she had hung up the phone. Aline had always known an impressive number of curse words.
"We do have the mortal sword," said Helen, "the one from Thule. It's hidden, but Jace knows where and what to do. He won't let Alec do it himself."
"Couldn't we, I don't know, try to capture the demon? Turn it back into Magnus?"
"Oh, honey, I don't know," Helen said wearily. "I don't think there's any way of coming back from being turned into a demon. And Magnus wouldn't want to live like that."
"It's not fair."
Aline kicked a good-sized rock. It sailed off the edge of the bluffs. Helen could hear it tumbling down the slope toward the highway.
"Magnus deserves better than this garbage. We all do. How did everything get like this? So bad so fast. Things were all right. We were happy."
"We were in exile, Aline," Helen said.
She wrapped her arms around her wife and rested her chin on Aline's shoulder.
"The cruelty of the Clave tore me from my family because of my blood, because of what I cannot help. The seeds of this poison tree were planted long ago. We are only now watching it begin to flower."
The sun had set by the time Mark and Kieran began their watch. Mark had hoped to be paired up with Julian, but for some reason Emma had wanted to go with Clary, and they'd ended up oddly matched. They walked for a while in silence, letting the dusk settle into darkness around them. Mark hadn't talked to Kieran about anything significant since they'd come back from Ferry. He had wanted to, ached to, but he had been afraid of making a confusing situation even worse. Mark had started to wonder if the problem was him, if his human half and his fairy half held contradictory ideas about love and romance, if half of him wanted Kieran and the freedom of the sky, and the other half wanted Christina and the grandeur and responsibility of earthbound angels. It was enough to make someone go out into the statue garden and bang their head repeatedly against Virgil. Not that he'd done that.
"We might as well talk, Mark," Kieran said. A bright moon was rising. It illuminated the dark ocean, turned it to a sheet of black and silver glass, the color of Kieran's eyes. The night desert was alive with the sound of cicadas.
Kieran was walking beside Mark with his hands looped behind him, deceptively human-looking in his jeans and t-shirt. He had drawn the line at donning any gear. "It does us no good to ignore each other."
"I have missed you," Mark said.
There seemed no point in not being honest.
"Nor did I intend to ignore you, or to hurt you. I apologize."
Kieran looked up with a surprised flash of silver and black.
"There's no need to apologize, Mark," he hesitated. "I have had, as you say here in the mortal world, a lot on my mind."
Mark hid a smile in the dusk. It was irritatingly cute when Kieran used modern phrases.
"I know you have as well," Kieran went on. "You were fearful for Julian and for Emma. I understand. And yet I cannot keep myself from selfish thoughts."
"What kind of selfish thoughts?" Mark said.
They were near the parking lot among the statues Arthur Blackthorne had paid to have shipped here years ago. Once they had stood in the gardens of Blackthorne House in London. Now, Sophocles and the others inhabited this desert space and looked out on the sea far from the Aegean.
"I believe in your cause," Kieran said slowly. "I believe the cohort are evil people, or at least power-hungry people who seek evil solutions to the problems their fears and prejudices have created. Yet though I may believe, I cannot help but feel that no one is looking out for the welfare of my homeland, for Faerie. It is, a place that possesses goodness and marvels among its dangers and trials."
Mark turned to Kieran in surprise. The stars were brilliant overhead.